Well, welcome everybody to the intermittent Strategus podcast on things that we think are important. I'm Pat Allwell.
I'm Ryan Grabinski.
And I'm Todd Sohn.
So we'll be talking about the markets. We don't know anything more than really the headlines. We're not giving you investment advice, but we do think that we're noticing some things that you might find interesting at home for your own portfolio. But we recommend that these things that we're doing are be accompanied by adult supervision. So rates are moving up a little bit. That's sort of a key thing, a key target for the administration too. Has to be some a disappointment there. What goes on, you think, with rates here?
It would appear that rates, you know, the secular trend in rates is likely higher from here. They've been drifting higher. Of course, you know, we'll find out. Obviously, tariffs are a big concern. That there's an inflationary or a higher prices associated with tariffs. I think what's actually more important now is that if we look at what's being talked about on the tariff front, at the end of the day, earnings estimates have to come down pretty significantly if we're going to go down this route of full implementation. The auto sector or the auto industry itself is expected to contribute about $26 billion to net income this year, and if we go down the tariff route, you know, that'll be cut pretty significantly. So on that standalone basis, you need to see downward revisions to earnings estimates. And then of course that doesn't incorporate any of the second order effects of these tariffs, and you know, then thinking about some of the DOGE policies. So that's you know, that's one thing right now. Obviously, if we look at the NTM earnings estimates, it's still growing at about 11.2%. Which is generally not associated with recessions, but if we get significant downward revisions relatively quickly, you know, that R word is going to come back to discussions.
And Todd, what do you see in the charts and momentum?
There's nothing there on the 10-year to me.
Nothing.
It's just one big range. Ryan's heard the stat already. The first cut was 6 months ago. Long duration is down since then.
What about buying in the TLT?
Still buying. Well, a lot of the buying has had to have been rebalancing. Because if you have a bond portfolio, the 40% and the 60-40, and if the long duration part of that, TLT, keeps going down, you have to buy more to bring it back up. So I just think it's interesting that you have a very uncommon environment here. Long duration typically rises after the first cut. So I think that it also speaks to why stay on the short end. You get the same yield, similar yield, way lower volatility.
Right? So I have to ask the question on these auto tariffs. You know, there's an Italian saying, when something bad happens, yes, che bene, who benefits? Who benefits from these tariffs?
It's hard to see anyone that benefits in this scenario, right? We chatted about this earlier today, but consumers, you know, you're likely going to see higher auto prices. So that's you know,
and
not going to...
High auto prices when the average price of a car is $48,000.
Right. And then clearly the share prices of the automakers are not moving higher on this. So clearly the automakers don't benefit from them. Now there is, you know, there is the potential for maybe Tesla to benefit. It has more domestic manufacturing than the other automakers. But
domestic content, you mean?
Domestic content than the other automakers. But you know, the real beneficiaries are probably used car sellers of used cars. Think about Carvana and CarMax. They are, you know, used car prices are likely going to move higher. And if we look back to the pandemic and one of the areas that actually accounted for some of the inflation that we were seeing, used car prices were a pretty significant component of that. Maybe we're at the precipice of kind of unanchoring inflation. You know, that's kind of a bold statement, but, you know, that might be being reflected in some of the 10-year yield.
Well, one thing I'd share with you, at least, and Don and I have had discussion about it, is tariffs, I don't think, are inflationary. They raise the price level to make us poorer. They might cause shifts in demand and consumption, but the auto chain is so complicated. I think I saw in the journal this morning that one of the biggest auto manufacturers that would benefit would be Honda, because they make that... tremendous automobile known as the Accord in Ohio. So there are a couple of things that sort of stood out really in the past week. I was talking with Chris, talked about the yen dollar back in August, the biggest change ever. China stock market back in September, big rally there. And then German bonds, biggest move in 30 years, as all suggesting that we're focusing too much on domestic. We should be focusing on international. You mentioned something very fascinating, Todd, the morning meeting earlier in the week about EMM relative to the S&P. was finally breaking out. Tell me more there.
See, I think that's a lot of the China exposure there. That's helped. Because other parts of EM are still inconsistent. India is in a bear market. LATAM is very inconsistent. So I think the influence of China on EM is what's driving that relationship. EM is not for everybody. I prefer more nuanced, active approach, I think, than the vanilla benchmarks. But it's the same with international. There's far less tech exposure there, right? And tech is the center of the storm here in the U.S.
So can you have a bear market with tech going down and the other stocks holding steady? Just that's not the definition of a bear market. Everybody goes down.
It's not a regular bear market, right? This seems more like what I would call a passive bear market then.
Well, we should also acknowledge, I didn't do it in the beginning, happy anniversary to Mr. Market. Oh, yeah. This is the 25 years ago this week was when the NASDAQ peaked, and people really didn't understand what was going on. In January of that year, AOL was the Time Warner AOL acquisition occurred, and the New York Times paper record said it was fantastic. Didn't work out that way. And there have been so many bad mergers and acquisitions since then, it's hard to say which one is the worst.
Time Warner has gone through so many M&A deals that have not done very well.
Yeah, it's just been disaster. I remember they bought, the cable business right now is, I don't know whether it's even a business anymore because you have streaming and all that other stuff. I just don't get it.
Well, speaking of M&A activity, I think that's one corner of the market that's basically been non-existent. That was largely expected to make a pretty significant comeback in a Trump administration where the regulatory environment was supposed to be more favorable for capital market activity. Even the IPO market has been as dried up here as well. We saw CoreWeave this morning announced that they're going to downsize their IPO. I think it was supposed to be I forget the numbers, but like 55, and then maybe it's down to 40. And you know,
I saw also Nvidia is going to backstop it, or at least going to put $250 million in. I'm wondering whether or not it's setting up for like this Facebook IPO, which proved to be a disaster in the beginning and a great buy in hindsight, or whether or not CoreWeave, and again, I don't know anything about it other than the fact what I read in the journal over the past couple of days is that they have $9 billion in debt. They're going to use $1 billion of the IPO to pay off some of the debt. And the debt is secured with their NVIDIA chips, which is a little bit reminiscent vaguely of Lucent.
Yeah.
Which lent extensively to their client base that wasn't making any money. So when they collapsed, then Lucent was dragged into the arms of Alcatel years later.
You know, we may have actually got a little nugget of information yesterday on the price collapse of their chips. And the reason I say that is because China made an announcement yesterday that they're not going to allow the usage of certain NVIDIA chips that are approved to be in China. And that's because they consume too much energy. And so, you know, that automatically in and of itself is kind of downward pressure on the pricing of the chip. So that maybe that's part of the reason why the IPO is seeing.
Yeah, we'll talk about energy. The global energy policy to me is just plain old stupid. So gold also, Todd, last time we were together, we talked about been upward trending. And you mentioned again something today that sort of stood out as remarkable. Tell us about the bullish sentiment on gold.
Very bullish. It only took a 5,000 year high.
Yeah.
survey data, which is always, you know, it's more, are you bullish or bearish? It's just opinionated, is basically a...
This is retail or institutional?
It's a mix.
Okay.
Extremely bullish, top decile, top percentile bullishness.
Are you seeing that in the ETF flows?
Yeah, now the ETF flows have really perked up. The other day you did about $2.1 billion in a single day of gold ETF inflows.
Do you know if that's retail or if it's institutional allocation?
I think that are more model allocations now. When you start to get that size, to me, that's more institutional allocation. So it's an asset that you hard to stand in front of, but the herd is definitely in one direction.
So we were talking about the 25th anniversary earlier of tech. It's also March, 25 years ago, when gold was low. Gold was about 275 an ounce. It was when Britain sold, I think, half their gold reserves. It was called Brown's Bottom after Gordon Brown, the exchequer at the time, was selling gold. And they diversified into, I think, euro bonds. I don't know how that worked out for them. I'm sure they got their money back. But gold's compounded since then at about 8%, which is not something a cube of something that does nothing ought to do, other than the fact that it reflects this great global anxiety out there. Of course, we've been in a bull market in that for the past couple of years. You guys have been traveling.
Certainly.
Todd, I understand you've been playing some craps.
When was the last time you were in Las Vegas?
I have never been to Las Vegas.
What?
Never.
I don't.
I've been to Atlantic City. Atlantic City is like Las Vegas, but for poor people.
I don't believe that.
It's true.
I think we should bring you there.
I don't want to go.
Know they have a pyramid.
Really? Do they have a pyramid scheme?
I'm sure they have. It's called the pyramid. Casino.
They have the Eiffel Tower there. Statue of Liberty. I'm amazed you haven't been there.
I'm amazed. When I grew up, I didn't excel in geography, but I always thought the Eiffel Tower was in Paris.
No, it's in the middle of
the desert. They have it everywhere.
The thing I remember about Vegas, they have that big globe out there or something.
Spear.
The spear. And Kamala, in order to get elected, spent, I think, $750,000 or $800,000 to put her name and Tim Walz's name on it for like a week.
So let's talk about what's going on. I
was in Vegas for 3 days. Ryan was there for about 12 hours, literally.
That's what he remembers.
For the ETF conference called Exchange.
Okay.
So I had the opportunity to speak.
You spoke before the conference.
I spoke at the conference. Yep.
And what'd you speak on?
My ETF work that I do.
Okay.
ETF market work.
Okay.
That was good. Got to moderate a panel on outsourcing your CIO, and along the way met some of our clients. We had a nice dinner with some financial advisors.
And how was that dinner?
Rowdy.
Yeah, it was good. The conversation was great. I mean, I think everyone's concerned about the same topics: tariffs. Is there a Fed put? Is there a Trump put? And the answer is we probably have to feel more pain for ultimately those two to come about. The big thing that I'll notice I've noticed in my travels over the last call it eight or 9 weeks is that sentiment. I know that a lot of the consumer confidence data is showing there's a bifurcation between Democrats and Republicans in terms of confidence, but I've noticed that the same is true when it comes to spending. So, you know, I was in Baltimore, and clearly there's a much weaker sentiment towards spending in cities that are more closely tied to Washington, D.C. When we were in Atlanta, there was certainly no concerns about spending. I'd say Vegas. I wouldn't say it was overly crowded. Granted, I was there on a Monday and a Tuesday after March Madness. But the Uber drivers that I spoke to, they all said business was as usual. They weren't really seeing any slowdown. So I'm starting to wonder how much, you know, are we seeing this bifurcation in some of the soft data versus hard data? That we've seen, you know, this has been a topic of discussion for some time, but, you know, is a lot of the soft data that we're seeing in the weakness in, is it going to come to fruition in the hard data? Only time will tell.
How much is a hotel room in Vegas?
Depends on the hotel.
It depends on the hotel, but I could say I stayed at a different hotel than where the conference was, and mine was considerably cheaper than the conference hotel rate. But I also stayed right on the Strip. But the hotel the hotel is the cheapest part of Vegas. Certainly, you know, food going out is not inexpensive. Even Uber rides from to and from the airport and to and from different venues are not cheap by any means.
They wouldn't let me check out late out of the room. They kicked me out.
Yeah, I actually asked during check-in, I said, what are you checking in on a daily basis? And they said, we're averaging about 2,000 individuals on a daily basis checking in. Now the hotel, now that's about 50% occupancy.
It's a huge hotel.
Yeah, huge, massive. They have about 4,000 rooms. But I said, what does it look like going forward? And they said, well, for May and June, we're actually going to see an uptick. We're closer to 3,000 people checking in on a daily basis.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's these are big numbers. Like, I thought it was interesting. Yeah, it kind of goes against the consumer confidence data.
We should take you next time.
Well, I will tell you, when you're out and about, as I was in a place, I think it's called Tree Vita in Chicago last week, and it was like a movie set. You know, all these good-looking people sitting down, having fancy wines and things like that. Needless to say, they set us in the corner, but then they saw Chris Verone, so they upgraded our table. But it was, it was packed. I guess you can't live by anecdote like that, but certainly in Boston, I think, is the same way.
Yeah, Boston was the same.
Now, consumer sentiment is a coincident number, but there is a breakdown on a partisan basis, but I think both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are a little bit more worried about inflation.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's...
As investors are.
Yeah. And that's reflective in yields, frankly, right? Like, you know, you'll get the two-year yield that's kind of been floating at that 4% rate, hovering at 4%. 10-year seems like the bottom is closer to 4.30, and it's really kind of hard to push through those levels. Now we're moving upwards. So
one thing before we go. So John Byrne has had a pretty good report recently on energy, specifically highlighting coal, and the coal stocks led by Peabody have done fairly well. I'm not recommending it at this level. I have no idea anything about Peabody other than the name. But is energy just a value trap here, Todd? I mean, it's been doing counter with
energy has done nothing for 3 years. Okay, so that's interesting to me because it's on the timelier side, but it's been opportunity cost. But you have seen a lot of money leave the energy sector in ETFs. So if you're looking for something that's defensive, but it's not staples, utilities, healthcare, then you go to energy, right? A little more cyclical.
Does the XLE have a yield to it?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, though.
Okay.
I'm starting to wonder if there's this gravitation towards energy, because in the past, the energy sector, when you start to see an uptick in inflation, energy is generally one of the sectors that benefits from that. Energy and materials are really the two. If you look at some of the ETFs, they have higher exposure to the energy sector. And perhaps, you know, investors are starting to sniff that out and think, okay, energy is actually a little more attractive here. If you look at, if you look at the administration's plan, right, their plan is to have three more million barrels a day of oil. That's probably not realistic here domestically, but I don't think there would be any style points. The bottom line is they want lower energy prices.
There was a report out just this past week from the Dallas Fed. Mm-hmm. That suggested in the Permian Basin, the average that a driller needs to be profitable is $70 a barrel, which I thought was high. There are parts mentioned that are a little bit lower, but on balance, they had once talked about $45. That's not even on the chart.
Well, I think there's a distinction that needs to be made when you look at that data, because to drill a new well, the break-even is $65 to $70 a barrel on average. For existing wells, the break even is closer to $40.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's the distinction. But what the administration is talking about is new wells.
Right.
Right. And so if we're at $65 to $70 a barrel now, there's not really much incentive for energy companies to go out and drill.
Well, one of the things, though, that it is interesting about the price of energy here is that if it might lead to more innovation, right? It might be getting more milk from the same cow rather than...
Yeah, I mean, that's always, that's always a possibility. You horizontally drill further, or maybe AI technology helps them.
Maybe we could drill something through Louisiana, through the Gulf of America, into Mexico, and surreptitiously, like they said on that movie, There Will Be Blood, like a big straw, suck all the oil out of Mexico.
And that would be...
They wouldn't even know it.
That would be the right mix.
It would be fantastic.
We could do that.
Maybe we could go all the way down to Venezuela.
Forget Mexico.
The president finds out about this, we're all
screwed.
Forget
Mexico. We should be on the border of Canada, right? That's probably more realistic.
So we're going to end it here, but Todd, what's cheap in the market, you think? Anything? What's cheap?
Cheap on a valuation basis?
Yeah, what would you buy? Anything?
Energy.
Energy.
I think energy's worth the flyer. XLE or RSPG, it's equally energy.
They are... ETFs.
Yeah.
Todd? Brian?
I still think the utility sector is interesting. I think there's an additional need for, the additional need for power generation is not something that's going away. Have we reached a little hiccup here? Perhaps, but, maybe the sell-off creates a little buying opportunity longer term within utilities. I don't think that's a narrative that's going away. And it's not particularly expensive the way, say, technology is when you look at it on a valuation basis. Despite the sell-off, the tech sector is still one of the most expensive sectors out there.
So one thing before we go. So two stories, because I love these EV stories that I continue to follow. Mercedes makes a top-of-the-line Mercedes Maybach, sells for a sticker price of $196,000, 1 year old, 10,000 miles. The bid is $100,000. Cadillac has just introduced out their new Cadillac Escalade. The thing that stands out about the Escalade, it has tremendous range because they put a lot of battery, and a lot of battery means a lot of weight. The thing comes in at 9,100 pounds, empty. You put five men the size of Ryan Gabinski in there, you're talking about five tons.
Well, that means more infrastructure.
That's going to break sidewalks in Fairfield, Connecticut.
The more of those that sell, the more infrastructure spending we're going to need on roads.
Well, we need a lot of infrastructure. Thank you, everybody.